Their biggest result from these excitements in Massachusetts, before they won the overwhelming landslide that won all of the reforms and put currency policy back in alignment with the people, was there was a huge outflow from Massachusetts. So people went to Vermont, people went to New York, people went to Western New York, Pennsylvania. They were going to the frontiers. There were some towns that didn't have enough people left to even hold town offices.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and I have to confess, one of the more enjoyable aspects of hosting this radio show is to go back and explore our country's rich history for stories that perhaps most of us overlooked when we first learned about them. Yet they have important lessons for today. And these stories, you know, are presented to us in a way that may or may not be totally accurate. To my listeners, do you remember learning about Shays Rebellion? Does that ring a bell? It did for me. And I remember it vaguely as, to be honest, and this is no reflection on my history teachers, it was probably more me looking out the window, but I seem to remember it as a bunch of protesters, unruly protesters, being put down by George Washington or maybe some of his troops. And this was a good example for a strong central government, which led to the creation of our current federal system. Anyway, that's the way I remember it. Maybe others had a better reaction to it. But why am I thinking about that? Well, because recent years we've had a lot of dramatic protests in this country. In our hyper-divided politics, just think back. I mean, the No Kings protests recently, the anti-ICE protests, which tragically led to losses of life, the Black Lives Matter protests, and the January 6th protests in Washington, D.C. Where's the line between protest and a strong central government coming in and putting down protests to restore order? This book has important lessons for that, and I'm very pleased to have the author with me today. Daniel Shays' Honorable Rebellion, An American Story is the name of the book, and Daniel Bullen is the author. Dan, thank you so much, and thanks for your patience with that really long introduction.
No, I love it. I love the picture of you staring out the window in history class.
Well, it's better to be honest than have somebody correct me down the line. But I really, for our listeners, this is a great book. And I think there's a lot of reasons to like it. Hopefully I can get to some of the more exotic ones a little later, some of Dan's passions. But set the stage here for us. Where are we in history as a nation and our government and also the economy, which plays a strong role in us?
Sure. So these events took place in 1786, right? So we're 10 years out from the beginning of the revolution, 4 to 6 years out, depending on how you date the end of the revolution. The Northern War was over in 1780. Southern War, the war concluded 1781 at Yorktown. 1783, they strike the peace at the Treaty of Paris. And 1784, this thing kind of gets started. One of the precipitating events, besides the huge debts, was the British said, oh, you want to be free? Great, be free. You can't trade in our ports anymore then. And this created an economic crisis because they were basically depriving Americans of a huge source of revenue that came from selling their goods to the Indies. And that kind of set everybody at each other's throats economically. Again, 10 years after the revolution, and now people are starting to feel like, did we fight for nothing? Or are we just a powerless country? Do we need to just jump back with Britain? And there's even echoes of the Oliver Cromwell and the Brits resuming control, or the monarchy resuming control. People started to wonder, do we only get 10 years without a monarchy before we have to go slinking back? So those are the historical echoes they're hearing at the time. The events that we're talking about, 1786, took place in all 13 states. All 13 states were deprived of the Indies. All 13 states had the same economic problems. Massachusetts and Virginia in the forefront, right? Because they had taken the largest debts and sent the largest numbers of people to fight. But in all 12 states besides Massachusetts, the governments figured out how to maintain the balance between all of the interests, right? Whether it was managing currency policy, managing how money was printed, managing how debts were going to be valued. All 12 other states figured out how to strike a balance between the parties. There were protests in other states, but nothing like what happened in Massachusetts. But in Massachusetts, you had an upstart group of merchants had taken over once the British had fled, and they didn't have experience striking that balance between the parties. They were just competing amongst each other to see who could get what in this new state, this new nation that they were building. So that's the local story for what happened in Massachusetts. There's kind of a tricky history with what's known as Shays Rebellion. I'm always going to put that in air quotes because it's the propaganda term for what we're talking about.
Right.
Shays Rebellion is like a nationalist term for, you know, propagated by Henry.
I'll get to that in a minute.
Straight.
Let me, who was Daniel Shays? Was he this wild-eyed radical out leading people, stirring people up with pitchforks and torches, the way it's kind of portrayed here?
Right. I mean, the way that the propaganda came down, they needed somebody to hang this on. That's why Henry Knox invented the term Shays Rebellion, like 6 weeks into the protests. And in the popular imagination, Daniel Shays was at the same time, right, a drunken degenerate inflaming the passions of the people, and on the other hand, a military genius who was going to rule the state with an iron fist and overthrow the government of Massachusetts. So it's kind of an incoherent comparison, and the reality is he was ahead of a local militia. He was well respected, you know, from the men in the ranks up to the officers. He had worked his way up through the ranks during the revolution, as did a lot of people. He was given a sword by General Lafayette in order, as part of the motion to kind of create an officer corps out of these, you know, green farmers, to create a nobility of leaders. He was given a ceremonial gold-handled sword, which he sold to pay a debt, because the people, the farmers who went off to fight, had almost no money. So the officer class felt like that was a betrayal. My reading is that the farmers he fought with would have felt like, yeah, you got to pay your debts, and who needs these swords when you have a serviceable sword you can fight with, right? So he was somebody who was kind of caught in the midst of this kind of evolving class structure.
And a lot of the farmers he led, I thought it was interesting. Again, these weren't rabble rousers, is the way it seems to be portrayed. But many of them, as you point out, were veterans of the battle for independence.
Right. And, you know, it's important to say that, you know, the Shays Rebellion is remembered as a period of unrest. There was about 18 months of petitioning and town conventions and regional conventions. There was one big meeting before they kicked off their first protest. They had a big meeting in Hatfield in August of 1786. 50 towns sent their delegates to send a list of requests to Boston to address the crisis that they were under. And when they did finally protest, they came to town with fife and drum, with uniforms if they still had them, with guns at their shoulders. And what they were sending was the message that, hey, we're the people. We're the people who are getting screwed by this current financial situation, by these people from Boston who are not listening to us. They're just ignoring us, adjourning the legislature and going home. But what they were also sending was that kind of the flip side version message was, they were telling the populace, we are not that democratic mob you've heard so much about who's coming to, you know, redistribute the wealth and take things that are not ours, right? We're here just because we're suffering an injury. And so the whole contest was really more of a public relations battle between parties than it was never a military conquest or a military conflict over, you know, looking for control over resources. It was always just a play for the people's hearts and feelings, which, you know, might echo some for today.
It absolutely does, and I want to talk about that in just a second because that's got parallels to today. But what was the specific, after they try through education, through legislative means, and that doesn't work, what was, they kind of upped it up a little bit as far as their tactics to get their point across. Well, describe what happened there and how that, and then the government's, or the, you know, the central authorities' reaction.
Sure. Well, it's and we can get back into this into more detail. But I need to say, first of all, that the farmers weren't just angry about taxes, right? What they were watching was really an explicitly, offensively flagrant land grab. I mean, the government was redistributing the resources in the state, and the people were pretty furious about it. They felt like they were being brought under lordships again. So when they're petitioning, they're already showing restraint. They're already using constitutional methods to try to get redress. They're being ignored. And after the government adjourned in 1786, they just, all the wealthy, you know, members of the legislature went back to their estates for the summer. The people started by obstructing the foreclosure courts, the courts of common pleas, they were called. And these are the courts where property is going to change hands, right? And they're there to say, the people find it inconvenient, it was one of their letters, for the courts to meet today. So what happened, you know, realistic terms, was about 1,500 guys under a bunch of different town authorities, all coming in with their flags, again, fife and drum uniforms, making this presentation to the people, showed up, surrounded the court, and kept the judges from entering. And at the time, there was a lot of kind of ceremonial pomp and circumstance around the courts, and the judges were escorted into the courts, carrying a staff of some sort, by the sheriffs locally. I mean, it was a performance, and they interrupted the performance. So they set up around the courthouse and told the judges it was inconvenient for them to meet today. Then they typically parleyed, and this happened over a dozen times. We're talking between August and December of 1786. They surrounded the courts, the government men then surrounded them. And to get a picture of the parties, you have the people's side, right? They called themselves regulators, right? They thought these were the people who could regulate their own affairs. And these are largely veterans and a lot of their families and the kids in the families. But these are people who've been working and fighting alongside each other for generations. And on the government side, you have some kind of senior officials, some lawyers, some clerks, and a whole bunch of kids who were too young to fight in the revolution, who came out from the towns to kind of pick up a gun and look tough. But it's worth remembering at every step that these were people who had just fought a war against Britain. They knew the price that they had paid, and nobody was interested in spilling blood. It was really a failure from Boston. And when they finally talked to the judges said, we don't have the authority to settle this. So you're going to have to wait till the legislature can do something. So the people then asked the government officials who are surrounding them, surrounding the court, if they could have permission to parade. So they basically staged a step show in the plaza in front of the court. And so the men would go out with the fifes and the drums and to the left ho, to the right ho, and they're making this demonstration for what good order and discipline looks like. And then they would go back to their spot, and the government would come out and they would make a similar demonstration. And I found it really difficult to research because the records were tricky, but this thing went on for 4 days, and they camped, not too far from each other, posted sentries, but there was never a stone thrown through a courthouse window. And that's the biggest part of me telling the story, is to debunk this idea that it was a violent insurrection in Massachusetts. The people showed tremendous restraint. Even when they were being cut up, the people were showing tremendous restraint. And they were operating under a nonviolent kind of protest concept, what was get in the street, interrupt the government's business, and show the populace, the general populace, that, hey, we're the people, and we're suffering an injury. The government and the people are out of alignment. We need to bring that back to alignment. And that was a tradition that went back to England.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Daniel Bowen, who's written an excellent book on an aspect of American history that, again, we tend to just glide by and not really grasp, I guess, the details and the contrasting views of what happens, just like today in a lot of ways. But this book is called Daniel Shea's Honorable Rebellion, an American Story. And Dan's been kind of setting the stage here on what's going on, what this was about, some of the key characters involved. The things kind of come to a head at a federal arsenal, and why don't you take up the story there before we kind of talk about the big picture meaning here?
Sure. So when these protests started, the government adjourned in July. The people started protesting at the end of August. The government response to the protests was to issue a really strict warning that if you continued to protest, you would be arrested, taken out of your country, whipped 39 times every 3 months, forfeit your land and property to the government, and deputies were indemnified against liability. So if the deputies killed anyone, there was going to be no accountability. So the people are becoming more and more furious, but they're also showing restraint. And I think Daniel Shea's role was really to keep them in line. The government finally lost patience in January. Even though there's knee-deep snow in the roads, everybody figures they're done for the winter. But James Bowden in Boston issues arrest warrants for 16 men who are leading these protests. Daniel Shea's first among them because he's become kind of the scapegoat. And the people find out about these arrest warrants, and they find out that an army is coming from Boston to arrest them and basically impose martial law in their region. They find this out on January 10th. And, you know, the big story is Shea's Rebellion. Oh, isn't that when people marched to the armory to take the guns to overthrow the government? They waited from the 10th. They didn't approach the armory until the 15th, when that army was a day and a half out. Right. I can't sustain any view that these people were interested in overthrowing the government. They never made any motion in that direction. Of course, it's being sold that way. Right. You've got Henry Knox in Boston telling George Washington that 12,000 to 15,000 desperate and degenerate men are preparing to wage a war against liberty and the idea of good government. Right. So the threat for the founding father class seems, you know, really urgent. So they send this army out. And the people, as I understand it, in their own words, they marched up to the armory, which was surrounded by 900 men. Daniel Shays comes with a force of 1,200. At 250 yards, he's met by an envoy who says, "What do you want?" Daniel Shays says, "Barracks and stores. We want to be inside and we don't want to be, you know, keep eating out of our knapsacks here this whole time." It was also winter. They wanted to have this discussion from inside. So I understand them at that time saying, really looking for it was a last-ditch attempt to negotiate by occupying the arsenal. And this is a federal arsenal where they've got muskets, cannon, firepower, or, you know, gunpowder, and a lot of provisions, right? And they've got this army on its way. When they continued to advance, they were met at 100 yards, this force of 1,200 men lined up coming down the road in eights, right, knee-deep snow, at dusk, 4 p.m. on January 25th. And they're told, if you keep going, they're going to fire. And they actually, two different people responded to this envoy, Daniel Shays and also Adam Wheeler, who was an artillery captain in the war, said, "It's what we want," which is a fascinating response, right? Because they were playing by a set of rules where whoever shoots loses, right? And that is what happened. So they took gunfire, they took cannon fire over their heads as a warning shot. They kept coming. General William Shepard from Westfield told the cannon guys to lower their cannon to waistband height. They discharged another volley of shots. And of those, you know, lined up by eights, they murdered four and wounded 20. So the first three lines of people approaching the armory are shot down, bleeding in the road. And the people did not load their guns and rush and create a battle. They ran away to cries of murder, murder, because they were playing this out in the press. And they knew that they had just basically won the war. The rule was whoever shoots loses. And they now had the bloody shirts to wave in the marketplace saying they're shooting us down, they're cutting us up. And you can see the outpouring that we had in Minnesota, you know, after Pretty and Good and the other fellow who were murdered, with that one came out later. But once there's blood in the streets and shots are fired, people can't tolerate that. And so there's got to be a reckoning. And the remarkable thing is that people still kept kept the peace. After this whole thing was settled, there was some kind of score settling, and a few people's, you know, law offices and potash works and warehouses were set on fire. But in an organized sense, these people never gathered and lined up for battle, right? So it's a story that I love to tell because the people kept such restraint. I didn't tell, you know, you hinted at the Whiskey Rebellion. There was tarring, feathering, murdering, arson. I mean, it was a lot rougher out in Pennsylvania 4 years later, but it was over the same securities. It was over the same exact documents, like the legal tender that the government had issued, that the government was now going to pay in full, and they were going to pay it in full by taxing the people. Like, that was the offensive heart of this whole thing, was that the people were being basically taxed to pay the full value of their own war pay, which they had given up at the end of the war for 10 cents on the dollar. And now they have to pay these speculators that full value. And when they can't, their farms are going to be seized. So that's a little more than just angry about taxes.
What happened to Shays after this?
Shays?
Some of the other farmers that were...
Sure. So this whole biggest movement for their biggest result from these, you know, these excitements in Massachusetts, before they won the overwhelming landslide that won all of the reforms and put currency policy back in alignment with the people, was there was a huge outflow from Massachusetts. So people went to Vermont, People went to New York. People went to Western New York, Pennsylvania. They were going to the frontiers. There were some towns that didn't have enough people left to even hold town offices. That, you know, they were just hollowed out by this foolishness in Massachusetts. Daniel Shays ended up in Vermont. There's actually a local exhibit for us here in Bennington, Vermont, that they just opened, I think, last week or two, that's artifacts from the village that they built with their own hands 1,900 feet up a hillside in starting in 1787, because they've just been kicked out of Massachusetts. They requested asylum in Vermont. And Governor Chittenden and the legislature in Vermont said, we can't have you here. We don't want to get involved in this. We're trying to come in as the 14th state. Leave us out. So Governor Chittenden signed the order saying that they couldn't stay, but then kind of refused to enforce it. But that makes the last part of this story kind of a refugee story. Because by that point, Daniel Shays and his men are kind of stateless individuals, right? They're not welcome in Vermont. They're not being extradited. They're kind of being hunted by government forces, and there's spies all through the region. And basically, come April, we have elections. The people win in a landslide. By June, James Bowdoin is out. John Hancock is back in. And the fiscal policy becomes normal and bearable again, was the arc. So I think this is a beautiful legacy of nonviolent resistance leading to electoral reforms.
No, but some of the farmers did have to turn themselves in and decided to go by the government's terms as far as, what, apologizing, whatever.
Right. And they had to give up their guns, which is fascinating. And they were they denied the vote? I think that they might have been denied the vote for 3 years as well when they signed this oath of allegiance. And they set up trials. Robert Treat Payne traveled around the state, you know, putting people up on trial. Pretty much nobody was, you know, people were arrested. Two guys in the end were hung for breaking into houses and roughing people up out in Berkshire County. But basically they held these kind of hostages. They would arrest people, keep them in jail for a year or so with these threats over their heads. And nothing ever really came of it, which is kind of also the solution that they imposed to the Whiskey Rebellion. Was George Washington went out with an army of 13,000 people, arrested a couple hundred guys, kept a few ringleaders in jail, and just said, don't make any more trouble or these guys get it, right? But again, I think these problems were really driving westward migration because, you know, if people didn't want to live under this spell of federal power, there were places that they could do that. They had to fight wars to do it, but that's part of what was driving people west.
That's the great tie-in to Heartland Politics, is this is what led to a lot of our people coming out this way. But in reading your book and in a book on the Whiskey Rebellion, one common thread you mentioned a couple already is Alexander Hamilton, who really, you know, he's our founder. He's on, what, a $10 or $20 bill? I forgot which. And of course, he had the Broadway play made about him, made him even more famous. But he doesn't come out looking too good in either of these books.
No, he comes out looking terrible. Like I said, these veterans, just to be clear, were the first creditors to the government. They gave their time. They gave their service. They expected to be paid for that. And they were given worthless paper money in the beginning. Then they were given, the trouble started when they were given these promissory notes. And at the end of the war, they didn't think the government was going to pay them. So they gave these things up for 10 or 15 cents on the dollar, but they stayed in circulation. And so by the time Shays' Rebellion, so-called, begins, 35 guys in the legislature are holding 40% of those soldiers' notes issued in the state. And James Bowdoin is holding 3,290 pounds of these notes at a time when 70 pounds buys you a 100-acre farm with a woodlot. So the people were really furious to be paying the value of their own war pay to people who hadn't fought, who just collected it on a financial speculation basis. And when John Hancock came back in and he said, all right, we're not paying the war debt, we're just going to collect taxes for state, you know, state expenses, they stayed in circulation. And it was Alexander Hamilton who engineered the, you know, the creation, the assumption of the state debt in 1790, 1791. And really, as you read the history of the Whiskey Rebellion, it really looks like he's the agent trying to press the policies that will get people furious, that will trigger the justification for a federal crackdown. And that sounds very similar to me to what's going on today, where they've been floating the Insurrection Act, holding that over people's heads this whole time. You know, don't give the government a justification for doing what it's already doing, right? But the idea was, you know, we need to keep the peace so that we don't trigger that thing, even though the mechanism was already in place.
So the parallels to today, and I'll ask you a wrap-up question here in a second, but what I see, I mean, first of all, I mean, messaging. We sometimes think politics now is just totally different from at the beginning of the country. No, oh no. No, there's a lot of parallels, and I think you mentioned Henry Knox messaging this war in a way that served his own ends, and the end of a strong central government is one example.
Right.
I mean, there's several others here, but... You mentioned, we got about 2.5 minutes here. Your subtitle, An American Story. Wrap this up. What's the lessons for today within, you know, an essential American story?
Sure. Well, so this story is being told in middle schools right now. It's part of the Massachusetts curriculum. And when they say that the unrest to, you know, that led to the Constitution, that it caused the founding fathers to realize that they needed to, you know, need a stronger federal government, I read the fine print is to protect against dangerous poor people. And George Washington in a letter said that mankind, when left to themselves, are unfit for their own government, right? Which is an astonishing thing to get from our first commander-in-chief. The book, the Daniel Shea's Honorable Rebellion, takes its title from the Thomas Jefferson quote, where he's, you know, watching this from France, but he says, Can history produce a rebellion so honorably conducted, right? And that's where he said, God forbid we should ever be 20 years without such a rebellion. So the American story that I'm really thrilled to tell is this long legacy that we have of standing up for what's right and winning reforms, you know, through nonviolent protest that brings in the populace. And I think that America has a really great legacy, which, again, I'm thrilled to be telling here with the book.
A populist, just one last point. Populist is misused so much now. It's totally kind of given to the right and the Trump and MAGA movement. And that is, there's no question about that. But there's a history also of populism from the left. And my congressman here, former Congressman Lane Evans, described himself as a populist Democrat. And this is what you're talking about. So I want our listeners to know that in 30 seconds, if you have something to add, Dan.
Sure. No, I've always loved this story for exactly that reason. It's, you know, when I found this story, Occupy was recent. Bernie was just getting on the scene. These conversations were just getting started. But what I found was this is a story that the Trump folks could love because it was men going to the courts with their guns and, you know, winning justice. And it was a story that folks, you know, the Bernie folks could like as well. And I feel like if anything's wrong with this country right now, it's that you have a large critical mass of people who want common sense things, who mostly agree with each other, who Bernie was talking to him, Trump was talking to him. They all agree, but our media is so good at keeping those people at each other's throats. And my hope is always that once people realize that they have these common interests, they start to have much more productive conversation. I'll just put it that way.
That's a great way to end up, and I appreciate that a lot. And it is truly an American story, as the subtitle says. Dan Bowen has been my guest today. He's the author of Daniel Shea's Honorable Rebellion, American Story. Very interesting. I encourage my listeners to pick it up and maybe even read it for July 4th as our country's 250th anniversary. Dan, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.